have to say that my primary reading material is the 1,000-page city council packets that we get each and every week. So I'm really looking forward to kind of a rekindling of social togetherness once the COVID crisis abates, and that we can form, you know, more of those connections and kind of build that stronger community. And I think people will have a real appetite for it after we've all been cooped up in our homes for so much time. So I think this is a real opportunity for us to build a stronger, tighter community going forward.
Hello, Boulder and the wider world. This is the Sharing Boulder podcast. My name is Philip Ogren, and for our second episode, my co-host David Adamson and I interviewed City Councilman Aaron Brockett, a resident of North Boulder's Holiday Co-Housing neighborhood. Aaron was on the planning board for 5 years before being elected to City Council in 2015. I first became aware of Aaron's work on City Council when he was endorsed by a grassroots organization called Boulder Progressives in 2019 for being a candidate that, quote, understands the connections between housing, transportation, and climate action, and has the will to implement real change in this area. In an upcoming episode, I interviewed David about ideas for adding gentle infill projects to the street he lives on, including a pilot project he has been trying to realize for years. But he has had difficulty getting the green light from the city of Boulder. We interviewed Aaron on January 30, 2021. A day after the City Council rejected further consideration of the pilot infill project, despite Aaron's own attempts to breathe life into the discussion. Our conversation covered a range of topics, including the co-housing project he lives in North Boulder, the relationship between community and sustainability, affordable housing, 15-minute neighborhoods, car sharing, and much more. This episode refers to a number of people, organization, projects, and books. Please visit our website at sharingboulder.us for show notes and links. We hope you enjoy our discussion with Aaron Brockett.
Aaron Brockett, we're so excited to have you. You're a city council person. You're a former planning board member. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about your background.
Sure. Yeah. And so professionally, I do software. My wife and I started a small business in 1999 and worked from home, worked together for many years. And since then, gone on to work for another company more recently, but do software for my day job. And in the evening, I do city politics and try to work from my position as a city council member to, you know, make our community a better place, help as many people who are struggling in town as I can. I also focus a lot on transportation and land use issues. As you mentioned, I was on planning board for 5 years before I got on city council 5 years ago. So I stay busy trying to make our city and our world a better place.
And could you share a little bit about where you live?
Yeah. And so I live in the north edge of town, Boulder, in the Holiday neighborhood. And I live in Wild Sage co-housing. So if you're not familiar with co-housing, it's a kind of a community where everybody has their own private unit. It's all townhouses and condos, but there's more common space than in your average HOA. So we have a lovely clubhouse and a common green. And so it's very common to walk outside and see your neighbors and chat with them a little bit, talk to them about what they're up to. And so our kid, we've been there since 2004. Our kids are middle school or they're both in high school now. But when they were little, it was just, it was so wonderful to see them all running around the block playing with the other kids. So it's a great way to raise children and to be more connected with your neighborhood and your community.
And that's an important subject of our podcast. We're also really focused on creating highly satisfying, highly connected neighborhoods where people feel that they know their neighbors and have a deeper connection with the folks that they live around.
Across the street as well lives Jim Leach, who is a co-housing pioneer over the decades. And one of my favorite quotes of his is that community is the secret ingredient in sustainability. And that when you have neighborhoods with strong social cohesion, where you know your neighbors and you can you know, rely on each other to for some resource sharing and support on childcare and other things, that makes you know, our whole community more sustainable. You know, you're able to live more lightly on the land and share resources and things like that. So
creating a whole new housing project, as Jim Leach has so admirably done, I think 21 in the United States with 14 in Colorado, an amazing career, and what a huge contribution Jim has made. We wanted to talk to you today about the neighborhood infill pilot, which a variety of housing folks and some staff worked to get into our Boulder Valley Comprehensive Plan. How can we introduce different housing types at different price points and preserve affordability? But you could just say when you got on the planning board and when you got elected, and just talk a little bit about the problem and the opportunity from your perspective.
Yeah. Well, I've been working on these issues for 10 years, first 5 years on the planning board and now 5 years on the city council. And, you know, the thing is that Boulder is just a fantastic community. It's a wonderful place to live. Our natural setting is extraordinary and our bike paths are wonderful. We have a fantastic downtown, et cetera, et cetera. So there are so many reasons why Boulder is a desirable place. And that's great, right? We all love living here. But the kind of the problem is that desirability has put an increase on our housing prices steadily for decades, really. But it's gotten steadily more strong in the last few years, so that that our single family neighborhoods, which when they were built in many of them in the 50s, 60s, 70s, were affordable to people who are solidly middle class, are becoming now out of reach to all but folks who are really quite well off, right? So, you know, the question is that, you know, how can we maintain income diversity in our town as prices keep going up? And so a lot of that work is done with our very successful affordable housing program. Almost 9% of our units in town are deed-restricted affordable housing units. The neighborhood I live in, the Holiday neighborhood, is 40% affordable housing. So that's very successful. It's been great, but that's only, you know, 9% of the units. So what we need to make sure that we have attainable housing in some of our housing that's market rate, that's not deed restricted, right? So that our market rate housing is in different shapes and types and price points, so that people with a variety of incomes can afford that market rate housing. And so, you know, part of that is you know, in places with, you know, good transit and such, is denser developments, you know, condos and townhouses and things like that. But then there's the question of how can we work in some housing variety into our existing single family neighborhoods, which are constitutive a large percentage of the residential land in our city. Well, you know, we'll just be frank, you know, we're not going to go in and rezone tomorrow and say that you can build apartment buildings in every single family neighborhood. That's kind of a non-starter. But what are more ways of gentle infill, this is a term that we like, about getting different types of housing sort of embedded in to single family neighborhoods in a way that works out well for the adding new options and for new residents, but also, you know, works out well for the people who live there already. And so, you know, all that is to come up to is like, so we're looking at what are some different ways that we could do that. And there's this idea of a pilot program, you know, for neighborhood infill, is to say, is there a neighborhood in the city where people are interested in, you know, trying something like this out of, you know, maybe it's, you know, houses could have, you know, two accessory dwelling units, or maybe you could put a duplex on a corner in the same footprint as the, you know, an existing single family home, or, you know, try a few things, you know, ways of blending different housing types into some existing neighborhoods. So I think that has a lot of promise, you know, particularly starting it in a kind of limited area and get people who are excited about it in the neighborhood that's really interested and give it a shot. So that's where this idea of a pilot program comes about.
I'm wondering if we can step back a little bit from that too, to look at the whole frame. And if you could talk a little bit about the transportation and other impacts of this lack of affordable, especially for sale housing, you know, what have been some of the impacts and maybe the unfortunate aspects of it for everyone in the community of not having this you know, especially workforce housing available?
Right. Well, I, you know, Boulder is a popular job center. You know, we have a lot of major companies that are located here. And for some of the same reasons that it's desirable to live here, it's desirable to work here as well. So so the issue is that we have about 100,000 jobs and we have about 100,000 residents, you know, plus or minus. And that means that gives you an imbalance because many of those people who live here are not working in those jobs. And we have, the number varies, but, you know, 40 or 50,000 people a day, pre-COVID anyway, driving in from out of town to these jobs here in Boulder. And so because, you know, we haven't added a great deal of housing, you know, over the last fairly large number of years, you know, there haven't been as many opportunities for people to live here who work here. And also the housing that we've added, much of it has been pretty expensive. And so people who are in more middle-class jobs really struggle to live in town. So the problem with a limited housing supply here means that we've got more people living further away who work here with them, meaning that they're driving in from a good distance with the attendant congestion and climate impacts that go along with that. So part of the desire to add more types of housing in town is so that we can house our workforce here in the city. And you're never going to get everybody living here. There's always going to be some people who live outside and come into work, but can we get it more of a balance?
There's a lot of air pollution associated with that. There's a lot of stress associated for those employees. And that has disadvantaged our businesses in a way because they have a real hard time hiring and retaining employees.
It is certainly something that we hear from our local businesses that among their very largest concerns is the lack of affordable or attainable housing for their workforce, right? So it is an issue that comes up with local businesses all the time. Now, at the moment, we're still getting, if anything, increased commercial demand in Boulder. But, you know, the fact is that's not guaranteed to last forever, right? You know, just ask a city like Detroit or other Rust Belt cities, you know, whether their initial economic success persisted for a long period of time, right? So we need to make sure that we are able to provide some of that housing for those local businesses so they continue to thrive and be successful.
The premise of this, of the neighborhood of the Gentle Infill, is that people are actually impoverished by not having a mixture of people around them. And of course, how closely and how well it's done is part of the issue. But I'm wondering if you could really comment on how much people's concern about that is actually related to auto congestion, you know, both the pollution and the noise, parking lots. So I'm just wondering if you could express how much of people's resistance to density or compact development is really related to cars.
Well, certainly a lot of the concerns about, you know, new construction, new residential, you know, comes down to issues around parking and congestion. That's a lot of what we hear about, is that people fear that traffic will get worse and that there will be limited parking, and they don't like either of those things, right? So, but the question is how can we, you know, move forward in more of ways of creating, you know, mixed use, walkable neighborhoods, you know, near, in these what we call 15-minute neighborhoods, right, where you can meet most of your daily and weekly needs within a 15-minute journey by foot or by bicycle. And so the opportunities, where are the opportunities that we have to take places that are near those amenities and put together new developments that are very friendly to walking and biking, and where people can meet most of their needs without a car. And, you know, clearly the cars are not going away. People are still going to want to use cars for a lot of some functions, you know, big errands and things like that. But if you build, you know, new neighborhoods in a way where car needs are minimized, then you don't have nearly as much parking and traffic impacts as you would otherwise. And ideally, you know, you're bringing in if you're housing the workforce of people who were commuting in from out of town, you know, you've reduced some of the impacts of those longer trips on the road. So we see that. And I'll just say up here in the Holiday neighborhood, that it's parked at less than one parking space per dwelling unit, which is much lower than many other areas. And it works out great. You know, we can walk to a lot of things. We can bike to a lot of things. And it's living proof that you can have a car light style of living with the right design. And that idea of kind of fleets of cars that you can share is a really promising one. So like there's a new affordable housing development for seniors going in on 33rd Street, I believe it is. It's 100 units of affordable senior housing. And the idea there is that all the cars will be shared, that they're going to have, I don't know how many it is exactly, but 15 or 20 cars for the community, and that you check them out. And so instead of everybody having their own car, you just have a group of them available to you. And so the amount of parking in that development is much lower than in typical development. The number, total number of cars is much lower. And I think we're going to be looking at some of those similar ideas for the Alpine Balsam development as that moves forward. You know, there are a lot of ways that you can meet people's needs, without everybody needing to have one or two of their own personal vehicles. And so I think a new development is a good way of doing it, right? So if you have a master developer, they can create a program like that as part of what we call the transportation demand management plan. You know, every new development has to have some form of transportation demand management to ensure that they're reducing the number of single occupancy vehicle car trips. And so that's a great opportunity for a new construction to implement something like that. We don't have it built into our codes right now, but certainly something worth considering to really encourage that or maybe require it in certain circumstances with some kinds of developments.
Aaron, the difficult situation in Boulder and other high appreciation cities, you know, while we try to innovate and figure out a way, meanwhile, all the housing stock is rapidly gentrifying, making any kind of solution more difficult. And certainly that's the case here in Boulder, where the Boulder Housing Partners identified back in 2014 that we really lose a net 1,000 units of affordable housing per year because of resale and remodeling. And so we took this former middle-class town, we're doing a big demographic experiment of making it all the for-sale housing is for wealthy people. And a lot of the neighborhoods are only for wealthy people, and they're diversity deserts. And the framing we're trying to bring to this is this diminishes life for everyone. This is denying us all of something that the United States is really about bringing people together, and we get so much from diversity. And so, the pilot program was an opportunity to try to show people that we can have that diversity, and it's actually preferable. And then there is really the racial, the illegal per the Fair Housing Act with disparate impact, that the result of this kind of zoning, the preponderance of single family zoning, has the result of segregating people, certainly by income and by race, and is illegal. And Kurt Nordback made a great article about that back in 2015, we'll put in the show notes. So I'm not trying to have you wave a magic wand around, but I'm just wondering if you see that particular issue as a problem, that the way we're doing it now doing a few things on the edges and having some rental housing is great, but that the way it's really going, needs to be radically changed, or we're just going to end up where we're headed of being, an Aspen, a Vail, et cetera. I mean, do you see that as a problem?
Well, yeah, it's certainly something we want to work on. I just want to challenge your language a little bit there, David, in terms of diversity desert, because I don't want to erase the people of color that do live in those neighborhoods, because they do exist, right? So it's not like that there are no people of color or people of diverse backgrounds in those neighborhoods. But the danger is that as the housing gets increasingly expensive, that, because of the racial wealth gap in our society and the lack of the ability for African-Americans and other people of color to build generational wealth over the decades, in large part due to housing discrimination, that when your housing stock gets extremely expensive, that means that you have a less ethnically and racially diverse community on average, right? So it's a danger, and it's a concern, because it's important to me, and I think to many of us, that our city and our community have people from a wide variety of incomes and ethnic backgrounds and races and other kinds of diverse backgrounds. So this is something that's really important, and it's one of the aspects of the problem that we really need to work on, right?
So, but
that,
it's not. Is, go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's a large motivator for continuing to work on our affordable housing program and for continuing to work on adding different kinds of housing at different price points.
So but it's not important enough. Let's just be very frank about what's going on here. It's not important enough to really confront it directly. We could build, you know, within the existing framework, and that's what I was trying to say, the existing size, we could build small units, for sale units, to have workforce people of all races live in those areas, you know, in single family zoning areas. We could change that, allow a different kind of housing in those areas and achieve that goal. You can, without subsidy, have a kind of housing that looks like the surrounding housing, that's for sale housing, but the council has been unwilling to really grapple with that idea and allow this infill, even just a few examples of this to exist.
But that doesn't mean that you can't do the kinds of things that you're talking about exactly, where you can add some different kinds of housing, like, for example, you know, a building of the same size, but that has multiple units in it. And I think that's a great opportunity to do things like that, you know, where again, you can get those attainable price points in market rate housing, potentially, you know, by having some more and smaller units. And then make sure that you've got the right approach to, you know, make sure those are places that are within walking distance to amenities, right? So that everybody doesn't need a car, and they play a role in those 15-minute neighborhoods and you know, walkable and bikeable and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So I think there's huge opportunity for, you know, innovations like that. And so I was disappointed that council this month wasn't willing to take up that possibility, that pilot, this year, unfortunately, but my hope is that maybe next year could be the year where we could look at trying some of these out and seeing what's successful and how we could move forward with some of those more, you know, the broader types of housing and price points.
How can we help people deal with their natural concerns about having more people? You know, people can be great. People are great. We love Americans and we love their diversity. People have a natural fear of adding Americans and their cars. How can we, in a respectful and engaging, successful way, help people realize that they can really benefit from this change?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I mean, I think part of it is just an attitudinal thing. Like, I think having a few more people around, you know, can be a really beneficial thing. You meet some really interesting folks, move into your neighborhood, and learn from them. And you know, people are from different backgrounds, and that can be really benefit. So I think people often focus on the potential downsides of having more people in their neighborhood, but I personally think it can often carry real upsides, you know, to have some new neighbors. People in my neighborhood has a sign out in her front yard saying neighbors for more neighbors, right? That's something she sees as a positive. So that's a kind of a philosophical thing, but I think part of the key is that if you know create some of these new projects that have come with their own amenities, you know, so they might have a coffee shop or a little greenway or, you know, a plaza or something that goes along with them, so that new developments, you know, some of them can bring additions to the neighborhood of desirable amenities, along with some of the new people that they bring. And as you do that kind of over time, as you have some new developments come in that provide services to the people who live there, it can kind of become a net positive rolling snowball effect, you know, where new developments bring kind of more customers to the existing businesses. They cause maybe more new businesses to start up in older buildings, and then they bring some new businesses with them. And anyway, you can get a kind of positive feedback loop going with some of that stuff.
I'm wondering if you could also highlight some hopefulness around, you know, having communities be more connected, know each other, know the idea that, hey, it's great to have a connected community.
Well, I think, you know, knowing your neighbors and having a strong connection to other community members is a key piece of your community being a resilient place. You know, so this is something we've talked about, resiliency, over the years in town, that one of the ways to you know, to make sure that your community is kind of can manage through crises is when people know each other, when they know their neighbors, and when they are part of social organizations and they have connections throughout the community. So, you know, all these things have actually become attenuated through COVID, right? You don't see your neighbors as much anymore. Like, you don't have events that you go to, and all the meetings are remote and all those kinds of things. So I'm really looking forward to kind of a rekindling of social togetherness once the COVID crisis abates, and that we can form, you know, more of those connections and kind of build that stronger community. And I think people will have a real appetite for it after we've all been cooped up in our homes for so much time. So I think this is a real opportunity for us to build a stronger, tighter community going forward.
We ended our interview with Aaron with a brief roundtable discussion about what we've been reading lately.
What have you read lately that's helped you in your challenging work?
Well, it's a great question. So I have to say that my primary reading material is the 1,000-page city council packets that we get each and every week. So that limits my other reading somewhat. But this week, the packet was only 250 pages, so I had a little more time. I've been reading a really interesting book that's been built from a website called 99% Invisible. And it's about how infrastructure pops up in subtle and interesting ways kind of all around our lives and throughout our cities. So it's full of all kinds of interesting kind of facts about how the things we take for granted about how our communities, our cities worked, actually came about. So that's been really interesting. And then I'll mention one other thing that I came across on the web just recently. The AARP, this is hardly a fun book, but the AARP just released a new edition of their kind of model plan for accessory dwelling units for cities and states. So this is very cool that they recognize the value of accessory dwelling units for multi-generational living. And so they've put out a new guidelines for how cities and states can put together model programs for encouraging ADUs. And so that was really cool. Read through that, and they had a lot of great ideas in that.
The book I'm excited about that I just finished reading is called Strangers Drowning. And it's a book about do-gooders, people who go to extreme measures to help people around the world or in their communities. And she just does a really great job of sort of weaving in ethical questions and dilemmas with these personal narratives of these people who, you know, there's a nurse who does a big portion of her life's work in Central America. There's a family that adopts a bunch of special needs children, you know, one story after the next. And I just thought it was like I don't know if it was inspiring, because sometimes I feel like you give your life over to helping other people, it's kind of pathological behavior, and it leads to extreme, you know, what many people would consider extreme. But it was motivating, because it really talked about what it means to be human and to help your neighbor. So it was a great book, Strangers Drowning.
Perfect.
How about you, David?
Well, I have finished a little while ago, No Ordinary Time by Doris Kearns Goodwin, a famous Harvard historian. And this focuses on the relationship between FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt from 1940, basically, until his death in April 1945. And what an amazing relationship it was, and it's really relevant to what we're talking about here about trying to make major change. How do you do that? And Eleanor was a real idealist, and so was Franklin, but he was a super skilled politician, obviously. But she just had an amazing assertion of a new role for women in politics and for the first lady. And it's just fascinating to see their interrelationship, you know, which is a lot about how to forward change about racial issues in the United States, and then obviously to move beyond isolationism to get the United States involved in supporting Britain and Russia. And so it's a fascinating story, and I think really related to this topic again about how do we help people see the benefits of a different way. Well, Aaron, I just want to thank you so much for all your service and your mild, thoughtful, innovative approach. It calms us. It makes us have hope. You know, your wife also in her activity with the NAACP, you know, you guys are such a power for good.
Thank you, Aaron. It was great talking to you this evening.
Yeah, it's a great conversation. And thanks for all you're doing. And David, I always appreciate your eternal optimism and you're constantly working to make things better.
This episode of Sharing Boulder was produced by David Adamson and Philip Ogren. Sound and video editing was done by Philip Ogren. The intro music was sampled from Osladum by Gilberto Gil and is available for use under the Creative Commons Sampling Plus license.